William Cohen and Janet Langhart Cohen have been married for a little over a decade now and have written a book together called Love in Black and White, a memoir of race, religion, and romance. They are both joining us here this afternoon. Welcome to KMOX.
Oh, great to be with you.
Hi, Paul.
Nice to have you here. Now, Mrs. Cohen, I'm going to ask you to indulge me for a few minutes because there's some stuff I have to talk to your husband about here.
What makes you think she won't be as informed?
Well, she's welcome to jump in here, but I'm going to go to you because of your role as the former Secretary of Defense. You spent 6 years in the House, 18 years in the Senate. You were Secretary of Defense from 1997 to 2001 during the last 4 years of the Clinton administration. And so I'm going to go to you on several things that have been hot in the news lately, and in particular, the story the Washington Post broke last weekend about the terrible conditions in Building 18 at Walter Reed Army Medical Center there in Washington, D.C. First of all, did you ever have any inkling that there were bad conditions at any of our veterans' Army facilities?
The answer to that would be no, and I doubt whether any Secretary of Defense would have that kind of detailed knowledge. Usually the Secretary is concerned about trying to manage the deployment of our troops around the world and being concerned about the security environment. And you rely upon, obviously, the Secretary of the Army and the various services and their administrative systems on down to oversee that. But clearly, there is a great oversight on the part of everyone concerning not only the administration, Congress, virtually anybody who's been there. I mentioned in a lighthearted way about my wife answering the question because she was going out on a regular basis to Walter Reed to try to bring some comfort and assistance to the severely wounded who were coming back. She was, of course, directed to the major rehab facilities and recovery facilities and not in this particular building. And so most people didn't see that. And I suspect that those people, the personnel at Walter Reed, didn't want anybody else to see that as well.
Yeah, I think that that's part of the problem there. And I had Paul Rykoff on the show a couple of days ago. He's the executive director of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America.
Yeah, he's terrific.
He is. And he has said that there have been many complaints lodged by many of these returning veterans about the conditions that they are facing, not only in Building 18, but in other veterans' facilities around the country. Why aren't those complaints being heard? How could things get this bad without anyone doing anything?
You know, actually, there have been complaints over the years about the Veterans Administration, and this is something that is it's got to be one of the saddest tragedies of all, that we ask these young people to go out and sacrifice limb and life for us, and they come back and they get into a system which really doesn't provide them with the quality of care that they need and deserve. And it's hard to explain why it is, with the amount of money that we're spending, certainly in sending them off to war, that we're not spending in terms of taking care of them once they come home. Now, Janet could tell you that she's been out there to see the kind of medical services that are available. Mm-hmm. But we have always been concerned, what happens when they go back to red state and blue state America? What kind of services are available either for the physical rehabilitation or recovery, but the emotional trauma as well? And I must say that we have been deficient over the years, and this has only heightened it because the kids who are coming back now are so severely wounded, and it's such a trauma for them. They're young. They may lose their families. Their spouses may divorce them. They may be left alone. We don't pay enough attention to them. I won't say we don't pay any. We don't pay nearly enough attention to them once they get back.
And Janet, because you've been there, let's talk about that for just a second, because I'm sure you were taken there on guided tours of what they had to offer.
That's right.
What you saw was actually the good news part of this, which is that our medical technology has gotten so advanced that they're saving a lot more lives, right?
Right, but I've never seen so many amputees in my life and so many brain-injured young people in my life, and the families, they're just distraught. But I'll tell you something about our military, which is the finest in the world. Things have to be really bad for them to complain, because they just kind of draw it up and just say, yes, sir, and what's the mission, and try to accomplish it. They don't like to complain. When I went out, I, of course, being the wife of the former Secretary of Defense, I'm going to see a different picture than ended up in the Washington Post. But I can talk about the human aspect that I saw, the young men and women who are serving and rehabilitating and healing our wounded that are coming back. They work night and day. They are just amazing in what they do. They are part of our military, too. These doctors that you're talking about that are saving them in the field are bringing them back home whole in spirit, if not in body. They're doing their level best to help them. And I think it comes down to we the people. We the people have a responsibility. It is we the people that they went and put their lives on the line for. So we have a responsibility. Yes, our government didn't do everything it should have. It's limited. But now that we know, now that the Washington Post has talked about it, you're talking about it, it's on television, some of our young people are speaking out, what are we going to do about it?
That's Janet Langhart-Cohen. She and her husband, William Cohen, have a new book out called Love in Black and White, a memoir of race, religion, and romance, which we're going to get to here in just a moment. The Vice President of the United States, Dick Cheney, said this week that we should leave Iraq when the mission is completed, and we should leave, quote, with honor, unquote. Those of us who lived through the Vietnam era remember hearing peace with honor. Am I the only one who's getting echoes of Vietnam ringing in their heads every time someone in the administration talks about this war?
Oh, I don't think there are a lot of comparisons that are being made in terms of how the war is going. We're in a difficult spot. I don't think there's any question about that. How we leave Iraq and what kind of condition and how we leave the region. And there are serious considerations about that right now on the part of all the Gulf states. I was just over there about 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, for the second time inside of a month. And I can tell you that everybody is worried, number one, that Iran is getting a nuclear weapon and what that means for their security. Number two, that Iran is going to be the new hegemon and that we are going to be on our way out. And so they want to know, does that mean that the insurgencies, the radical elements that are in Iraq today will be galvanizing forces in their countries? So this is an issue which is going to affect global stability because most of the industrialized world is dependent upon having stability in the Gulf states. So this is something that we've gotten ourselves into, that there's no easy answer here. Now, I was disappointed that the president didn't accept the recommendations or the majority of the recommendations coming out of the Baker-Hamilton report, because I felt that that offered the best opportunity to have a bipartisan coalition in this country to sustain that for at least 5 or 6 months, to then see whether the prime minister, Maliki, would be able to say, okay, now I'm going to take the tough political decision, and we're going to crack down on the sectarian violence. We're going to go after the militias who are carrying this violence on. And absent that, there are no amount of troops we could put there at this point in time and have a positive impact, unless you have a political will on the part of the government to say no more off bounds for the militias. They are every bit open now to the coalition forces taking them down.
And when we're talking about the militias, there is a lot of talk. You yourself invoked Iran here for their support of the Shiite militias in Iraq. Aren't the Saudis also to blame for their support of the Sunni militias and the Sunni insurgents?
Oh, I think that the Saudis have made it very clear to Vice President Cheney, as a matter of fact, that if and when we leave, under what circumstances, that they intend to continue the effort on behalf of the Sunnis. That's not a secret at this point, that they are going to support the Sunnis against the Shia majority, unless there is a settlement whereby the constitution that was adopted by the Iraqis, in fact, is going to be implemented so that you have a Shia majority, to be sure, but you have rights and respect for those of the minority, which are the Sunnis. And absent that, I think you're going to see a continuation of this war being carried on for some time to come. And that will be funded by not only the Saudis, but other Sunnis that happen to be the majority population in the region.
Yeah, that would be Saudi Arabia, our partner in peace.
Right.
Right. The man who replaced you as Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, was called this week by Senator John McCain the worst Secretary of Defense ever. What do you think?
I believe in one of Secretary Rumsfeld's rules, and that rule is don't get involved in passing judgment upon your predecessor or your successor. Because on the one hand, if you praise them, you'll be seen as being solicitous. On the other, if you criticize them, as being self-serving. So I've resisted that.
Okay, Janet, you weren't Secretary of Defense. What do you think?
I'm sorry?
you were the First Lady of the Pentagon. You can't comment on Rumsfeld either, can you?
Well, no, I don't know enough about defense. I just know that we, all of us, have a job to do in taking care of the men and women we have over there on the front line. And when you said that we have to bring them back with honor, however they come back with honor, because every day when they lace up their boots, they don't know if it's their last day. And they're willing, like Isaiah, to step forward. When God said to his masses, "Who will go for us?" Isaiah stepped forward and said, "Send me." And all of them over there answered the call of "Send me." So I won't judge Bill's predecessor. I don't know enough about the job to do that. That's not way above my pay grade. But I'm trying to get out of it, Bill.
Very good.
That's why you were the first lady of the Pentagon, because you can get out of that.
Let me say, Janet has been distraught over what has happened. And I can only say that when I was at the Pentagon, we did not feel that Saddam Hussein posed an imminent threat to this country or to the region. You can make an argument that he was a long-term threat, but in terms of an imminent threat, we didn't see it. We thought he was reasonably well contained. And we had him covered no-fly zone north and south. He couldn't move against his neighbors. And if he did, our plan was to send in 500,000 troops. There's a different plan that came in with President Bush, and they took a different approach. And yes, you could take down Saddam very quickly in a three-week period, as was done. But then the issue became, well, what do we do now, folks? How do we stabilize the country? Are we really basing our assumptions on assumptions that are real, or are they Memorex here? And it turned out that the assumptions proved to be without merit, that we'd be greeted and treated as liberators, that we would see the country become united, that we would have revenues coming in to pay for the operations, et cetera, et cetera. And so they didn't prove out. And as a result, we're paying a penalty for it. And General Shinseki, you may recall, was the chief of staff of the Army at the time, and he was asked by members of Congress in open testimony, saying, what would it take in terms of going into Iraq? And he said several hundred thousand. He was then criticized as being wildly off the mark, and of course he was wildly on the mark in terms of what was going to be needed to sustain stability and to create that stability so that you could have the seeds of democracy take root. But, you know, each administration will have to answer for itself. We felt at the time, this is prior to 9/11, and therefore I've been reluctant to join in being openly critical of the decisions made. It was prior to 9/11. But at that time, we felt that Saddam, number one, wasn't connected to to Al-Qaeda. And that, number two, that we really didn't want to go in, much like President Bush's father did not want to go in back at the end of the Persian Gulf War, the first one.
Because, as Colin Powell said, you break it, you bought it.
You own it. And yeah. The problem is, it's broken, and we don't own it. And that's the difficulty we're having now, and that's the reason for the anxiety in this country, the criticism coming up. I mean, think about what the American people have contributed here. We're talking about having spent at least $500 billion, that we've lost at least, well, more than 3,000 of our best and brightest. We've seen about 30,000 severely wounded. We have killed tens, if not hundreds of thousands of innocent people in this process, and they haven't seen the kind of progress that would warrant that kind of investment. And so the American people are saying, well, show us where the light is. And I think in the event that there seems that Maliki is able to get control of the sectarian violence, and we start to see some of that progress being made, you may see a different attitude on the part of the American people. But until that takes place, I think they're going to continue to be openly skeptical and doubtful about it.
It's News Talk 1120 KMOX. Paul Harris talking with William Cohen and Janet Langhart Cohen, who've put together a book called Love in Black and White, a memoir of race, religion, and romance, all about their marriage. He's white, she's black. Got married in the United States Capitol. What was your wedding gift from Strom Thurmond?
Well, he was there.
He was there, and he was a sign. He was almost 100 years old at the time, and we all know his history of being a segregationist, a Dixiecrat. And his gift was, to me, that this country has changed, has grown, because he had grown in nearly 100 years. And it showed that we have promise in this country, that Bill and I, an interracial couple, could get married under the Capitol Dome, a dome that was built by slaves, and I'm a descendant of slaves, that we could hold hands there, because just about Oh, I would say less than 10 years or maybe 11 years before, it was illegal in this country for blacks and whites to marry. We had to go to the Supreme Court in a case called Loving versus Virginia. Mr. and Mrs. Loving, who lived here in the Commonwealth of Virginia, were married and threatened with arrest by the authorities. So they took that case to the Supreme Court and struck down all the anti-miscegenation laws here in this country in about 16 or 17 states.
I think it's interesting that you talk about how Strom Thurmond had changed, and yet you were reluctant to marry him because you thought your race would hurt his political career.
Not Strom Thurmond.
No, I mean your husband, not Strom Thurmond.
Yes, I was, Paul. I was, because I had grown up in the shadow of World War II, where my father served in the Army and went to fight the Nazis and had to come back here and fight the Klan and racists, and was afraid to wear his uniform in his home state of Kentucky, and probably in Missouri at that time, and surely had to sit on the back of the bus below the Mason-Dixon line. And the promise of this country, the wonderful promise of this country, is that less than 50 years later, I, his daughter, marry the Secretary of Defense. So when it came to Bill and I getting married, he asked me several times, and each time I said, no, not as long as you have a career in politics. And he said, why? And I said, because I'm afraid that your state, Maine, and this country, ours, will not reward you by being married to a black woman. And fortunately, Paul, I had underestimated Maine, and I had underestimated our country.
I must say that I had never had a doubt that Maine, that the people of Maine would welcome Janet. And, of course, I was right and she was wrong.
And I'm glad to be wrong on that.
Yeah. Is it true that the first time you spotted her, you were blowing your nose?
Well, you did read the book.
Yeah.
That is true. I was really under the weather. In fact, I almost canceled the trip back home to Maine at that time. I was passing through Boston, had been invited to go on a program that I had never heard of. I didn't know anything about Janet. And
she was a huge star in Boston. Let's point that out. You had a long career as a big-time TV personality, particularly in that town, and then, of course, later on BET as well.
I've been blessed.
Because, you know, I talked about your husband's accomplishments. I got to mention yours as well. So anyway, go on with the story.
But in any event, I didn't know anything about Janet, but she did catch me at an inopportune moment, to say the least. But I looked up and saw her, and obviously saw a woman of great beauty. It was only later that I saw some of her interviews and saw that she was a woman of great substance and brain power, and it's an incredible combination of beauty and brains.
In all these years, one last question for you. How many times have people seen you together and then later seen you apart, or knew that you were a married couple and said to you separately, either to you, Mrs. Cohen, or you, Mr. Cohen, something about your relationship?
For me, I only hear great things about Bill. Bill is highly regarded in black and white circles all over the world, in fact. So I would only hear things like, you lucky girl.
And you can even have Bill O'Reilly, that we appeared on his show the other evening. He said, for him at least, it was a step up and for me to marry Janet, so it's not mine.
But you know what I mean.
But you know what I mean.
Have you gotten racist remarks said to you as a single person where nobody would say it in front of the other person?
Yes. Bill, tell about the U.S. Senator.
Well, I had one of my colleagues who will always remain unnamed, but he came over to me one day and he said, Janet, he said, which one of her parents is white? And I said, neither one. Why do you ask? He said, well, she's so intelligent. And it was an incredible comment because it really revealed a sentiment that is it may be widespread in this country, but it was part of this white superiority that if you've got some white blood, that must make you
better or smarter.
And
could have been worse. Joe Biden could have called you clean.
No,
articulate.
Let me defend Joe Biden because I know Joe. I serve with him. He hasn't got a racist bone in his body.
And I concur.
Thank you so much for your time today, and good luck with the book.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you, everybody.
Enjoyed it. Thanks.
William Cohen and Janet Langhart Cohen. The book is called Love in Black and White, a memoir of race, religion, and romance. This is the Paul Harris Show on News Talk 1120 KMOX.